Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this Monday morning, about 10:05 Eastern Time a.m., and we're going to talk about tax prep for 2011 returns, tax planning for 2012 returns, and take your calls, please, 202-465-3080. Now, this is two tax types doing the show, and we have Ed Zirndorfer, and if we do all his accolades, we might not have a show. So Ed is a certified financial planner. He's also called something called an enrolled agent. Now, for those of you that don't know what enrolled agents are, they are enrolled to practice in front of the IRS, and the exam is tough. I took one many, many years ago when it wasn't as tough and became one, but it's a tough exam. He's a registered rep with FSC Securities Corporation, and probably maybe many of you don't know, he's the moderator of Federal Soup, federal as in federal, soup as in SOUP.com. And it's, what would you say it is, Ed? I don't want to miss profile it.
It's a free, I'm going to emphasize the word, a free question and answer forum in which federal employees can send in questions about their benefits, and I will answer any question regarding benefits, which includes things like taxes, includes their benefits, insurance questions. I get a lot of questions about the Thrift Savings Plan, get a lot of questions about Social Security and Medicare. And if federal employees have any questions, they should go to www.federalsoup.com and send me a question. And if they have never done this, they want to check it out. All the questions that have been asked ever since Federal Soup started 11 years ago, have been archived on that website together with the answers. So they can check it out, and they can do a Google search on the website there to see if their question has been asked and listen and read the answer.
Okay, well, let's get at it, and probably we should start off with an email Mike got Saturday, Mike Causey, and handed it to you this morning, and it's from an individual that said, I retired December 31st, 2010, after a number of years, and I don't like to use names or even where the person worked, under CSR with a VCP. I recently received my form 1099-R. That's the form that one gets once they do retire, so kind of like a W-2, so that makes certain that the IRS knows what you made, and it shows up on your tax return. So it's the mirror image of a W-2, except you can read it. And it said that the 1099-R has included my entire benefit that you have to pay taxes on. In other words, the form said, we can't determine what the taxable portion is. I'm going to take a tangent to that in a second, but I have to read the email. And then it mentioned that the individual had put a certain amount of dollars into the program over the years, plus interest. Now, what do I mean by all this? When one receives an annuity from the federal government, as a civilian now, not military, as a civilian, a portion of it's non-taxable based on the fact that whether they're FERS or CSRS, they've put money into the plan over the years through involuntary withholdings. Doesn't have a thing to do with Social Security, doesn't have a thing to do with Medicare, doesn't have a thing to do with the thrift. And so that when they do retire, there's a recognition that some of that money that they receive in annuity benefits is not subject to tax. However, when somebody first retires, they're usually in, what do they call that, Ed, an interim pay
status? They call
status?
Their interim status in the sense that they receive their annuity payments, yes, but they're not really the actual amounts that they're entitled to because it takes OPM's retirement office anywhere from 3 months to perhaps as much as a year to determine what they're really entitled to. So OPM sends out what is called interim annuity payments that are sort of approximations of what they're really entitled to. What's the approximation? Anywhere from 50 to 90%, I've heard.
Right. But the point is they're getting people cash, but at the end of the year, because they did receive cash, they get one of these forms that say you have to pay tax on what you got. But because they haven't finally adjudicated all the paperwork, they really don't know the total amount of money that was put into the system over the years, so it's near impossible to figure out the tax subtraction. And that's why it says We don't know. It looks to be fully taxable, but that doesn't mean that it is. Because once it does come online, then OPM will make the calculation as to what's taxable versus which is not. But these interim checks, which it appeared this person received, showed it to be fully taxable.
Bob, you mentioned that this person, this is a distribution from the voluntary contribution program. Is that what it said on the email?
It says VCP because they really don't have anything to do with each other.
If I have to guess what the problem is here, is the fact that the individual putting money into the voluntary contribution program, you, of course, when you contribute to the VCP, you're using after-taxed money. The contribution.
That means you don't get a tax deduction when you put it in.
Exactly.
Right?
You do not get a tax deduction when you put the money in. And OPM that runs the program pays interest on the money contributed to the program, a nice amount of interest, good rates to attract money. But while the money is gaining interest within the retirement fund, individuals do not pay tax on that money. However, if they choose to take out the whole amount they contributed, they in a lump sum payment, which is one of the options, payout options from the VCP, they will pay tax only on the interest portion, not on the contribution portion. My guess is this person opted for that, decided to take, to request a lump sum payment rather than going for the annuity payout option or to roll the money, the VCP contributions themselves into a Roth IRA, which we have discussed on previous programs.
Yes.
And to take the accrued interest that was in there and to do a direct transfer to either a traditional IRA or to the TSP. They instead said, we'll take the whole lump sum payment, including contributions and interest, and now they must pay in, they must pay tax on the interest portion only. And I think you mentioned there's $26,000 of interest. So that portion, the $26,000, would be taxable, and I think you mentioned $187,000 or something.
It was a large amount.
They would not pay tax on. So that is my guess of why they're questioning why they're getting a statement showing $26,000 of interest on their 1099-R.
Okay.
That's my if I have to take a guess, that's the reason.
That's my gut. And remember, too, this person is or was a CSRS employee. Somebody else in the federal government could be a CSRS offset and still be eligible for the VCP. For the FERS folks saying, well, what about us? It's a short subject. You can't do it.
That's correct.
And we don't need to go into why or why not, but you can't. So it's just people with CSRS or CSRS offset. And one of the shows actually was devoted to this discussion, and it's the July 11th, 2011 show. But let's come on back to taxes. Not that that wasn't. Ed, people are now pretty much, they don't have all their forms yet, but they got most of them, I would imagine. They've got, although the 1099-Rs from OPM were a little late coming this year.
I received mine, Bob. I think you did not mention I am a retiree of the federal government. I worked under CSRS for almost 32 years, and I did get my 1099-R from OPM last week, and it showed the gross distribution of my annuity during 2011 as well as the taxable portion. So I'm very grateful to OPM to figure out what portion of my annuity is taxable.
Yeah, and they do now. They didn't years ago, but they do now.
That's correct.
I think for two reasons they do it now. It's only fair to the individual to know that they have a non-taxable portion, but I think IRS probably said, we'd like you to make this calculation rather than leaving it up to some taxpayers that would take liberties with this. Certainly nobody in the federal government. But nonetheless, I think that's why it is. Okay, so we're kind of getting our papers together, and you do a fair number of tax returns, and I do a fair number of tax returns. We'll probably ping pong with this a little bit. What do you feel that people miss when they come in to see you and they say, here's everything I got, and you go, well, what about this?
Well, here's the situation. I've gotten three returns in so far. Here it is, February 6th, and people came in on February 1st with their stuff, and they all have, all three individuals have one thing in common. They're missing stuff. They're missing important things in their files that will result in them, in most cases, getting money back, getting a bigger refund or owing less. And one of the things I'm noticing is that people forget about charitable contributions. They make charitable contributions during the year. And those people who itemize on income taxes. I had one individual who gave a nice amount of money to the combined federal campaign via payroll deduction and had completely forgotten about it. And I noticed on his tax return that his charitable contributions were almost next to nothing. So I called him up saying, "Did you make any charitable contributions?" He said, "Yes." So the result was that he made a substantial amount and he got some money back.
Great. We have a caller now, and maybe they want to ask a question about charitable contributions, but sure. They can ask about anything they want. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm the spouse of a federal employee, but I'm the tax hobbyist, okay? Now, if somebody retires in the year that they're 70 and a half, or they already are 70 and a half, and they retire on the 31st of December, for purposes of determining whether the RMD has to be taken for 2012, the current year, or whether their first RMD is in 2013. In other words, are they still employed actually through the 31st, or are they considered done and over with, they got to take it by April 1st? Of 2013.
Okay, now you're talking about the RMD, and for those of you all that don't know what RMD is called, required minimum distributions from things like IRS.
From TSP.
But I think here we're talking about the TSP. We're
correct.
Not talking about IRAs, although they're the same rules, but I think your question was on TSP.
Well, because if you're 70 and, if you're over 70 and a half, and you have an IRA, you still have to take your money out.
I understand that, but that's not the case with the TSP, and I think your question's on the TSP. So let's stay with the TSP, and then we can go to the IRA. But the folks listening just might want to hear the answer because so many of them are feds. So, Ed, what's the answer?
The rule is that if you retire from a company, or in this case the federal government, that has a defined contribution plan like the thrift savings plan, the rule is that if you retire after age 70 and a half, you must take your first minimum required distribution no later than April 1st following the day, the year in which you retire. If your husband retired on December 31st, I guess 2011?
12, it would be.
You're talking about this coming year, December 31st, 2012. Law says that he must take his first minimum required distribution no later than April 1st, 2013.
And if he took it on retired on January 1st or January 31st?
Okay, if he retired on January, if he retires on January 1st or later, then the first minimum required distribution has to be no later than April 1st, 2014. But keep in mind that if he retires January 1st or, after January 1st, 2013, yes, he can take his first minimum required distribution on let's say, March 31st, 2014. He's right up to the deadline. But he has to take another minimum required distribution for the year 2014. And that has to be done no later than December 31st. December 31st, 2014. Okay. So
but
by
you have answered the question in terms of it's just a matter of when you're working, you have a lot of income in the year you're working in.
Right.
And so maybe you don't want to be taking that required minimum distribution, whereas when you're getting just your retirement annuities and other things, your income's going to be much less, put you in a lower tax bracket. So I just wanted to know what the options were. And at December 31st, it makes a difference, being able to not take it till the following year. So maybe January has to be the retirement, unless they change from the high 3 to the high 5.
Well, let me ask you this. I assume he is under CSRS?
No, under FERS.
All right. Well, you see, there's another factor here. If he retires December 31st, 2012, let's say, he gets his first annuity check dated February 1st, 2013. However, if he retired on January 1st or later, or that month, January 2013, he wouldn't get his first annuity check till March 1st. He's going to lose an entire annuity check.
Right, I understand that, but the annuity under the FERS is not that large. Okay, so it's just the way it works out. So it doesn't become a problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate getting a clear answer to that question. So
All right, thank you very much.
It was our pleasure.
Thank you. It was a great question, and it does also point up the difference between distributions from a thrift and distributions from a traditional IRA. If somebody was still working, like we just kind of mentioned in January, the distribution gets thrown back for the thrift, but for the IRA, they don't have that same rule. You have to take it out of a traditional IRA, not a Roth, a traditional IRA, in the year that you hit 70 and a half or a year later, like Ed said. So their rule is a bit different for those that might stay on after 70 and a half. A lot different.
That's correct.
Okay, so the good question, and hopefully we covered both sides of the fence, if you will. Okay, Ed, now you had the individual that that was smart and just forgot about the money that came out for the federal campaign, I suppose. And you could forget about it because it isn't like writing a check.
That's correct.
What else do you find early on or from last year that people, I know people that are attuned to this, but they just sometimes miss a tidbit?
I had a client who was very anxious to get their taxes done because they have a child in college. And college is not cheap, as you know. And he turned the child, this was his freshman year at a local university. And I noticed that they didn't give me any information about tuition and fees. And there is a tax credit out there called the American Opportunity Tax Credit that started, the year before, in 2010, I believe, in which eligible individuals can get as much as a $2,500 tax credit. Now, you know this, Bob, that I love tax credits because tax credits reduce your liability dollar for dollar as opposed to a tax deduction. To make a long story short, I called up the client and says, "Didn't your son attend college this year?" "Oh, yeah." "Are you aware of this American Opportunity Tax Credit?" "Nope, never heard of it." "Well, if you give me information about your tuition and fees, and by the way, did you get anything from the university?" Because universities normally send out what is called a 1098-T, T for tuition. "Nope, don't have anything." "Well, go to your checkbook and see what you paid in tuition and fees and books. And give me the information, email me the information back, and I can see what I can do for you." To make a long story short, they ended up getting an additional $2,500 in a refund from the federal government.
Can I ask you a question? Many things in the tax law look back to something called adjusted gross income. Now, I don't want to get lost in technical terms, but it's kind of like your total income before your deductions. And a lot of benefits, like you mentioned, credits, not this one particularly, and the like. But this one, is it affected or unaffected by the size of one's income?
It is affected by the size of one's income. And if we're going to talk about these tax credits for education, we also need to talk about the tax deductions for education. There is a tuition and fees deduction in which eligible individuals can deduct as much as $4,000 off the top of their income. It's an adjustment to one's income. However, Bob, it is adjusted gross income, or AGI, sensitive. In other words, if your income is too high, you don't get it.
When we talk about this in class, and I've been doing this for years, when tax laws change, the highlights in the newspapers, television, and whatnot says, "Gee, here's this new benefit." And if we read the article, everything is great until we get to the last paragraph of the article that says, "Well, if your adjusted gross income exceeds a certain level, you just wasted your time reading the article." So the point being here is be aware that they're there, and also be aware of the limitations. And, of course, if you go to somebody like Ed, you don't have to worry because he'll catch it on the good side or the bad side.
Well, it's very important that, as I say, you keep up with any type of changes in the law. And if there's a significant event in your life that I call a lifestyle change, such as having a child, adopting a child, sending a child to college, you should talk with your tax professional to go over anything that may affect your taxes for the current year. And a lot of people, unfortunately, put it off or they forget about it and don't do it.
Okay. There's I think, I won't say a common, but it's not so outside the box. With interest rates dropping, people have refinanced their homes. And they may or may not have paid something called points. Now, if they do, normally I'm sure you ask to see the settlement sheet as well as I do, and I can pick the points out if they haven't already got it. But what sometimes they do miss is if they had refinanced the home prior to this one and they had paid points, they forgot to tell you about it, or they didn't know that they could write off the, quote, unamortized. So I'm using some terms here, but the bottom line is, if you refinanced your home, make sure, if you paid points, that you get the proper deduction on your return. If you refinanced your home and it was previously refinanced and there were points, make sure you get those.
When in doubt, ask your tax professional. Just ask the question. I'm sure the tax professional knows your situation, that you've been working with this person, and they can give you the honest answer.
And being one, sometimes people are a little shy to do it. And say, you know, I said, stop it. I said, this is what I do. This is what you do. You can ask me if dog food is deductible, and I can tell you no, but I won't laugh. And of course I won't laugh, but that's what we're there for. Now, we're also here to answer phones, and we had a really great question right off the bat, but we're ready for another. 202-465-3080.
Bob, you mentioned about real estate, and I've gotten so far on three tax returns, and one of these individuals, when they saw the amount of their refund, because they did, in fact, refinance their mortgage, and it seems like with the rates dropping, a lot of people refinance their houses. And when I showed them the result of the tax return, they gave me a long face. They got a nice refund, but they were expecting more of a refund. And I explained to them, well, the good news is your mortgage interest rate dropped from 5% down to 3.76%. Are you happy? Yeah, I'm really thrilled about that. Well, the downside of that is that you have less of a mortgage interest deduction for 2011. So, you know, on the good side, you're paying less on a monthly payment. The bad side is you're going to end up paying a little more in taxes because you have less of a deduction.
And let's go back to really put a point to what you just said, and you hit a bullseye. If you pay a dollar's worth of interest, you don't get a dollar more as a refund. You get whatever tax bracket you're in. And let's say the federal and state tax bracket, not everybody has a state because people listen outside the beltway here, but let's just say it's 30% for the sake of discussion. So you save 30 cents in taxes, but that's good. But I'd rather not spend the dollar on the interest because I get to keep 70 cents.
I agree with you fully, Bob. It gives us such pleasure in the fact that we are mortgage free. And yes, it would be nice during tax time to have that mortgage interest deduction, but throughout the rest of the year, we're very happy. We don't have a monthly payment for our house.
Yeah. There's another, and I'm sure you work with law enforcement officers that are retired. And as we talked about earlier in the show, there is a tax deduction based on one's annuity, again, law enforcement or not. But they get an additional tax subtraction for the amount of health insurance that they might have had withheld from the annuity. And it's called Public Safety Officers Tax Benefit. You just kind of like on, it's on line 16 on the first page of the 1040, and you write PSO, and whatever deduction you were entitled to claim at the federal level, you can add up to, underline the word up to, $3,000 because you're a public safety officer and you are retired and you're having health insurance benefits withheld from your annuity.
And I believe, Bob, that that is an adjustment to one's income.
Comes right off the top.
The second one of my favorite deductions, as you know, the tax credits are first, and I believe it is not adjusted gross income sensitive.
No.
You have to be in an occupation, public safety officer. You get to deduct up to $3,000 of your health insurance premiums.
And if your health insurance premiums were less than that, then it would be less than the three. If they were more than that, it would be three.
Is long-term care insurance included in that?
I do believe.
So that's if they're paying for long-term care insurance, they're paying the premiums for their long-term care, which includes the federal government has a long-term care insurance program, they could actually add that to the health insurance if it's, it turns out to be less than $3,000 in total, you know, if it's $3,000 in total, no more.
Okay, and just a word of caution to the folks that might be Googling this at you are a public safety officer. If you Google it and something comes up, public safety employee, don't read that. It doesn't apply to you.
Yes.
It's just goofy language, but people get wrapped around the proverbial axle with this, including yours truly, when they first started to differentiate between public safety officer and public safety employee. Okay, Ed. Schedule D. Now, for those of you all that don't know what Schedule D is, it's for reporting the gains or losses from the sale of securities. Now, I'm not talking about the people that trade. I'm not talking about the, you know, gazillionaires that do this. It could be as simple as a mutual fund. I won't say as simple. It could be as simple as the sale of a stock, or it could be a little bit more complex with the sale of a mutual fund. You really have to determine what your true cost in that was. And sometimes if you've held it for a while, you don't know what you paid for it. But IRS is really tough on this, not because it's bad, but it's because people could take advantage. Certainly nobody listening to the show would do that, but somebody outside the show might. And they have a new form for this. And the Schedule D is for the reporting of the transaction, but there is a backup form, 8949, that really drills into the basis. Right, Ed?
It's a new form this year, and it's hopefully going to help everyone, but I just want to mention that in terms of calculating your cost basis, IRS has come to our rescue because starting this year, brokerages, clearinghouses in which hold people, individuals, non-retirement assets, we got to mention this is for a non-retirement account, are obligated to tell you on the 1099-B, which is reported to someone who sold a capital asset, such as a stock, a bond, or a mutual fund during 2011, must report to the owner what the cost basis is on the 1099-B. Of course, there's always been the sales price. That's always been
there. Easy, yeah.
But my experience has been in the last couple of years, when the cost basis shows up on the form, they'll put a bunch of asterisks or unknown, and leave it up to the capital asset owner to determine what the cost basis is, which in turn means that the accountant has to figure out what has the cost basis is, and it could really cause some problems. But now the brokerages, the clearinghouses, anybody who owns in which these assets are invested must report on a 1099-B the cost basis.
Which would also then require them, if you were changing brokerage houses, to provide the new brokerage house the cost of the assets that you're transferring in.
That's correct.
All righty. Ed, energy credits. Energy credits are popular with everybody, but are they still around for the tax year 2011?
For 2011, yes, but as of now, not for 2012.
Okay. If anybody did anything in 2011, I've had some people say, I didn't know it was still around. Now, it was reduced relative to what it was in 2010, but it's still there. And, you know, for all of us that might be saying, what's an energy credit? What is an energy credit without going through geothermal stuff?
Well, it could be as simple as putting on new storm windows or storm doors or putting in a new furnace, a new air conditioner that meets the government standards of being energy efficient. It could be as simple as that. The law said, though, that you had to have the item involved, the storm, whatever you did to improve your house. It has to be a personal residence, by the way. You can't do this for a rent, get a deduction for a rent investment property. It had to be in place no later than December 31st, 2011. So if one signed a contract on December 21st to put in their energy credits sometime in January or February this year, you will not be able to get a deduction for it. It had to be actually in place by December 31st, 2011.
Okay, and as you mentioned, in 2012 thus far, it's not on the radar screen.
As of now, it was not renewed. I just want to put an asterisk by that. Congress may renew it. We'll talk about later some other tax benefits that were available in 2011 that are not available in 2012, but Congress may renew it for 2012 sometime this year, and they may make it retroactive to January 1st.
All right. All righty. The other thing that I'm not so sure everybody is affected by this, but more and more people appear to be, it's called the alternative minimum tax. And in class, they say, could you please explain this? And I said, we don't have enough time. But let me see if I can do this, and you fill in where I mess up. All right. The alternative minimum tax is a concept that says you do your tax return the way you've always done it. And let's say you put that in column A, and that has your normal income, your normal deductions, your normal income tax. And then they go, okay, over in column B, we're going to use pretty much the same numbers for income, pretty much. But for your deductions, we may not let you deduct state and local income tax, real estate tax, personal property taxes, which would be very common. You say, why can't I deduct it? Well, because under column B, we're going to recalculate your tax using a separate set of rates that are actually very akin to a flat tax. And it's recalculated. And at the end of the exercise, they compare column A to column B. Whichever one is higher, that's the tax you pay. But unfortunately, on the form, and it almost looks like a penalty tax. On the form, they use the number from column A, but if column B was bigger, they subtract the amount that is in column A from B, and they just add that to your tax bill, and they call it the alternative minimum tax. Did I do that simplistically enough?
Yes, you did, Bob. I just want to add one thing, though, to what you mentioned on the income side. A lot of people like tax-free interest. They invest in tax-free municipal bonds, if you will. Private activity bonds. The state, the city issues some bonds to build some private housing. And everybody loves the idea of getting tax-free interest, both federal and state. Well, the law is that any private activity bonds may be subject to the alternative minimum tax, which means that the interest that you get from those private activity bonds will not be taxable for the regular tax purposes, but will be added to the in the calculation of the alternative minimum tax.
Okay, so if I was talking with a broker, or if I was reading about the offerings at a brokerage house, and they say AMT bond, somebody might say, "Oh, that's nice," but isn't that what it means, that if you buy this bond, it may, and underline the word may, be subject to the alternative minimum tax?
That's correct. So you got to read the fine print. You have to ask your broker. Now, this wonderful tax-free bond, I'm not going to pay regular tax. Yes. Is it possible I could pay the alternative minimum tax based on the interest I'm getting from bonds? And the answer is yes. It'll state that on the bond that it is subject to alternative minimum tax.
May I ask you a financial planning question, Ed? Okay, so if I was looking at this and I call you up and I said, Ed, it's an AMT bond, what's that? And you just explained it to me, and then I'm probably going to ask you, do they pay a better rate of interest than what the non-AMT bond would pay?
They probably will, but you'll end up paying for it in terms of taxes.
Okay.
So you have to look at all sides here. You know, just because it's tax-free, it doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be the best thing for you. Everything depends on your individual circumstances.
Okay. Then if you are buying tax-free bonds, you might buy it for a certain dollar amount, but you also might pay a premium for it to the broker because the interest rate is higher than what you could make in today's market. Now, what do you do with a premium? You can do one of two things. Probably, if it's a tax-free bond, it might be better just to wait until you sell it and then claim it as an adjustment to the cost rather than – I'm not going to talk about the other option. It's too complicated. All righty, Ed. Sorry I got off on that tangent.
Just want to make a recommendation that if you're doing your own taxes, and many people do, and you're hopefully using software like TurboTax – just make sure that you run the alternative minimum tax calculation. It's actually IRS Form 6251, and I believe TurboTax does it automatically. But when in doubt, be sure to check it, okay, to make sure that calculation is run.
You know, another good point is, let's go into what Ed said. For those of you all listening that may be retired and you may be living in a state with a state income tax, depending on your age, you may get a certain tax benefit for living in that state. And I've had class members say, well, you know, the XYZ program didn't pick this up. Well, the only reason it didn't pick it up is, I don't care what program you use, it's only as good as the database in there. So if you lived in a state that gave a retiree a special tax benefit for living in the state, not always, but more often than not, it's dependent upon their age. So if you don't have your birth date in the profile, the machine wouldn't know. So make sure you look for that on your state return if you're retired and living in a state to see that you got the benefit. Now, if you didn't get it, why didn't you get it?
Yeah, that's a good point, Bob. And if individuals, retirees, have questions like that, they can always contact NITP or Federal Soup, myself, also the National Association of Active and Retired Federal Employees, NARFE, is a good source to go to when you have questions about taxes if you live in a particular state, because they do a lot of work in that area.
Actually, their Retirement Life publication once a year, many times March, sometimes April, it lists every state in the country as to being retired and living in that state and the particular tax benefit and the whys and the why not. So that's really a good magazine. Like you say, every month they have Phil and Mark, I believe, Keene over in Virginia. Now, this is a national publication.
Yep.
Write something on financial planning, and invariably there's Q&A questions on benefits.
I get a lot of questions when I do seminars for NITP. I go around the country, and invariably I get questions in different states. For example, tomorrow I'm going out to Illinois, and that happens to be one of the states that does not tax CS rest annuities, FERS annuities, and military pensions, and people are always asking me that question. I also go a lot to Michigan, and they also, till now, were a state that did not tax CS rest annuities and FERS annuities and military pensions. However, they're changing their law. The legislature met last year, and they're sort of phasing out this no tax on federal annuities. So I advise individuals, always keep up with changes. You have to make sure that what's true today, you know, is the law, because things do change.
Okay, and for those of you all listening, and it goes back to our first caller, the one worked for the feds and the other one maybe did or didn't, but if you're retired and living in one of these states, it doesn't make any difference whether you were a fed or not. There was a Supreme Court case many years ago that said if you're a state, you can't discriminate between state employees and federal employees or any other employees. If you're retired, you're retired. You're entitled to this.
Also want to point out, in addition to that a state may have one set of laws regarding how it taxes defined benefit plans, such as CSRS annuities, FERS annuities, and military pensions, and they have another set of rules regarding how they tax defined contribution plans, such as 401k plans and the TSP. One rule does not apply to both in many states.
Pennsylvania is a good example of that, where they'll recognize the tax-free nature of the TSP or 401k plan, as well as the federal annuity. Now, there's a reason why, but they do put everybody into the same boat, where other states would say, nah, we'll give it to you on your annuity, but we won't give it to you on your 401k. I think people in planning for retirement should never look at taxes being the beacon of where to retire. Otherwise, everyone would move to Alaska, because that is the best tax state in the country. But probably don't see a mass migration of retirees to Alaska, but it's certainly in the top five, wouldn't you say?
Well, according to Kiplinger's retirement report, the five best states for retirees, from the standpoint of all taxes, the first state is actually Wyoming. The second state is Mississippi. The third state is Pennsylvania. The fourth state is Kentucky, and the fifth state is Alabama. Okay. That's according to Kiplinger's retirement report, from the standpoint of all taxes, which includes income taxes, property taxes, sales taxes.
And they don't have Alaska in there?
Alaska's not rated.
Alaska doesn't have a state income tax.
And they doesn't
have a sales tax. And they pay you to live there.
And they pay you to live there, but I think the cost of living there is so high.
The cost of living there is high, yeah. And the climate might not be everybody's favorite. Also, for those of you looking towards tax planning in the future, with different states, most states, looking for any source of revenue that they can, we're hearing a lot of chatter now about what changes the governor or the legislature might want to make. Now, Maryland just happens to be very prolific now, but I'm sure Virginia won't be far behind. And D.C. already made some changes for with regards to municipal bonds starting in 2012. So just be aware that it's not going to be a major impact to you, but it might be a surprise to you if you don't have your eyes open.
Let me just say this, that states are very hungry for money because of the economic situation. They're looking for ways to make up for budget, you know, gaps and so on. They're doing everything. And another question I get in class regarding that is, well, if I spend my winters in Florida and in the state with no state income, like Florida has no state income tax, or Texas, no income tax, and I spend my summers up north in the state that does have an income tax, like Maryland, D.C., Virginia, what's my situation? Again, it gets a little complicated, but I have done many part-year returns for retirees in which they live at least 30 days in one state and at least 30 days in another state, and you have to make sure that you're covering all bases.
Right. So, and the other thing, some of the, for example, locally in Maryland, there are a number of people that move from Maryland because it's a high tax state and they move to a low tax state. But for whatever reason, they keep their home here, not because they're necessarily going to live in it, but they lose their homestead credit on their real estate taxes, which is a major number. And they don't like that. And sometimes the insurance in the new state of residence is awful high as well. And if they move to escape the taxes, they maybe didn't do as good a job as they would have liked to. But that, you know, all you got to look at all this stuff or have somebody help you do it. All righty. Any other, let's see, I think we hit the major things, but when somebody's preparing their tax return for 2011, is there anything that thus far that you've seen? You say you've got a handful. We've got a handful in, but can't get them out because software or IRS hasn't blessed all the forms yet. So we've got a little bit of a log jam.
Well, one of the things I'm very careful this year, and IRS is getting very particular about, is claiming exemptions, deductions for individuals. Can you legitimately claim that child? And the reason I say that is in this day and age where we have divorces and separations and so on, and can an individual legitimately claim an exemption like a child? And you have to ask a lot of questions, and there's some rules the IRS has, and I'm recommending that individuals when they you know, if I have clients and they list their exemptions, that their personal exemptions, that they're absolutely certain they're entitled to it. And I ask them some general criteria. A lot of times the problems come in, putting aside divorce and separation, I have individuals who have children who are getting to be like 22, 23. They're getting to the point where they may not be a member of the household. There's the support test, there's the income test, and I have to ask some very specific questions. So, again, you got to be very careful about that.
Extremely careful, because now they have another way to check it. If, unfortunately, somebody divorces and the child lives with, let's call it the custodial parent, even though they might share custody, the custodial parent is anointed as such. And the divorce agreement says that the exemption will be shared 1 year by one spouse and the other year by the other. Well, that's nice, but unless there's an IRS form filled out and signed by the custodial parent, the other one can have that written all they want, but the IRS doesn't want to get in the middle of domestic disputes and would deny the deduction.
Right.
So that's important. I think that's a new form this year. I'm not certain, but I think it's a new form.
I don't believe maybe it's a new form. A certain form comes to mind. I think it's IRS Form 2120, I believe, multiple support declarations.
Well, that's
like
one,
that.
But this one is... This one's, I think, 8,000. But whatever it is, it's a new form. The multiple support is where, what I guess, several people provide the support for somebody, but nobody more than half. and they assign it.
I've seen that with parents, Bob, where children are supporting a parent, multiple children. You have, say, 3-4 children, each supporting a helping to support a parent who gets to claim the parent as a personal exemption. And they can come to some agreement. And this idea of claiming exemptions on is important because it brings me to another point where individuals may not have the right filing status, single, married, filing jointly, married, filing separately, head of household, God forbid, qualifying widow, widower. I have to double check if the individual is still eligible to file for a particular filing status, because that can make a big difference in their overall tax bill by making sure they have the right filing status.
All righty. I'm sure you get this question with the folks that you work with as their tax preparer. And they, what can I do to save taxes? And, of course, if we had that magic wand, we probably wouldn't be preparing them. We'd be writing books. But one of the things that I guess anybody can do, but especially the feds, can involve a health savings account where there might be a high deductible plan. In other words, it's high deductible, and money goes into a health savings account. Really is a savings account, but it's like a super-duper deductible IRA regardless of your income, and you can use the money in there to pay for the medical expense or not. It doesn't make any difference. But unlike the flexible spending account, you don't lose this money. So it could be used as a savings account and then taken out at some later date in life.
That's correct. With a healthcare flexible spending account, the money that you put in for 2012, it's maximum $5,000. It's going to go down to $2,500 max starting next year. But this has always been a rule with a healthcare flexible spending account. If you do not use your money by the spending deadline, which in the federal government's case is March 15th for 2011, it was actually March 15th, 2012, you will lose that money. It goes back to the administrator keeps the money. On the other hand, with a health savings account, any money that you put in there that is not used carries over to the future. You can pull the money out to pay for out-of-pocket medical expenses like deductibles, co-payments. Also, with a health savings account, you can use that money to pay for long-term care insurance premiums that you cannot do with a healthcare flexible spending account. I'm advising federal employees that if they are a relatively healthy person, and if they're married, their family is, to consider putting money into a health savings account for the simple reason that the only time you can put the money in is when you're in a high deductible health insurance plan. And if you do not use the money in that account, you can use it to pay for future out-of-pocket medical expenses, including you can use it after you retire. You know, after you retire from federal government or you leave federal government, you actually can pull the money out of it also to pay for out-of-pocket medical expenses. And talking about retirees, I understand that you can use your health savings account money when you pull the money out to pay for Medicare Part B premiums that you also cannot do with a flexible spending account, healthcare flexible spending accounts. There are a lot of things you can do with the HSA. And as you point out, the only downside is you have to be in a high deductible health insurance plan. For this year, it's $1,200 if you're self only, $2,400 if you are self and family, if you have self and family coverage.
All righty, Ed, you're the proverbial wealth of knowledge here. How would one contact you, or would you prefer they contact you through FedSoup if there are questions after listening to your pronouncements?
The best place to send me questions, and again, these can be questions on benefits, federal employee benefits, financial planning, as well as tax planning, any questions about taxes, go to federalsoup.com. That's www.federalsoup.com, and send me questions through that website. And I'll be happy to answer questions. It's a free service provided through Federal Employees News Digest. And I write a column for Federal Employees News Digest called the Informed Investor column that comes out once a week. If you want to get that column, go to the website www.federaldaily.com.
And you were kind enough to give me today's print, February 6, 2012. And it gets back to our first caller with those great questions, but a little bit different. And it says, understanding inherited retirement plan RMD rules. and the first caller talked about RMD. This is succinct, it's there, and it's otherwise very hard to understand if you were to read it. So it's today's version, and it says understanding inherited IRAs. In other words, somebody unfortunately passed, and somebody listening may have received the money as an inherited IRA. The question then is, how do they pay tax? And if they trip, they will hurt.
That's correct. And many people are not aware of the fact that when they inherit an IRA from a relative, such as a parent, I mean, many of the baby boomers now are inheriting IRAs from their parents. They are required to take the money out, it's called the minimum required distribution, each year, starting the year after death. And if they don't, there's an IRS penalty. So they should be aware of these rules. And this article that I wrote does summarize those rules and what to do in order to avoid getting taxed. And by the way, if you do inherit a Roth IRA, you also are required to take money out of inherited Roth IRA. You don't pay tax, but you have to take the money out of it.
Okay. Now, for those of you all listening, if there are questions, certainly you can call Ed or email Ed. You can also email nitpinc.com. And I think we're running up against the end of the show here. And Andrew, the fine engineer, is saying, Bob, shut up. You're going to get cut off. So, Ed, final comments real quickly.
Real quick, to save on 2012 income taxes, what should employees do? Contribute as much as to the TSP. You can put as much as $17,000 into the TSP, $5,500 additional if you're 50 or older as this year. Take advantage of that TSP, because that's the one way you can reduce your taxes.
And listen to the show every week, especially next week. Bye-bye, and thanks for listening.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.